I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia, at thecommentary.ca. The historian Greg Markey joins me again. He has just published a new book, John Lennon, Yoko Ono, and the Year Canada Was Cool. It's a marvelous look at Lennon and Ono, their cultural significance and popularity, as well as what Canada was like in the late 1960s. It really was changing, and that was no better demonstrated than in the emergence of Pierre Trudeau on the national scene. Markey looks at Trudeau's image and how the spirit of the centennial year in 1967 propelled him into higher office and the country into a seemingly bright future. Greg does a very fine job at showing us the confluence of all of this in Canada, what with the wider context of conflict in Southeast Asia and how resistors of the Vietnam War were coming up against the establishment in the United States and elsewhere. This is all a very exciting and tense time in the world, and in this country it would all change by 1970, especially in the fall of that year with the October crisis. The book also looks at music in Canada and the vibrant scenes across the country as well. Greg Markey is a professor in the Department of History and Politics at the University of New Brunswick at St. John. He was first on this program in 2016 when his book Truth and Honor, The Death of Richard Oland and the Trial of Dennis Oland was released. This new book is published by Lorimer. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Greg Markey. Professor Markey, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
No problem.
You know, as I was reading your book, I kept thinking in a contemporary context about how to, say, equate how big John Lennon and Yoko Ono were in that time, say, 50 years ago, 51 years ago now. Is there anything that, for people listening who might not understand just how huge these two were and how fascinating they were to the public, is there something comparable to today, perhaps?
It's hard to, I don't know, celebrity culture changes. We seem to have more celebrities and they have more exposure to the public. But it just, people kind of forget how big the Beatles were. And this is one of the Beatles, and this is one of the songwriters from the Beatles. So I don't know if there's anything to compare to anything today, but it would be, I don't know, I would hazard, you know, Beyonce. I don't know. I mean, in terms of a cultural, I mean, these were not just people who sold records. They, you know, cultural cues from what the Beatles were doing, and increasingly by even people who weren't so young, you know, were sort of mimicking what the Beatles were doing just in terms of what they were doing with their lives. So it's really hard to compare the eras, but he was certainly, you know, to use that overused phrase, an A-list celebrity, right? And his wife, just by being the sort of eccentric wife, artist wife of John, became a celebrity as well, for better or for worse, right? So, yeah, it was a big deal. The globally recognized figures.
Well, we do forget, you know, that the Beatles, for that generation especially, I mean, they were, you know, to use a, use another phrase, the soundtrack of that generation. And when they meet their demise that they do, and then she's, you know, blamed for that, it's almost like a conflagration in terms of celebrity, isn't it?
Yes, well, Yoko Ono became a figure of controversy early on, even before the Beatles broke up in 1970. And of course, that was a huge moment in pop culture history and for baby boomers as well. And the fact that the Beatles sort of broke up in stages was, you know, sort of dragged things out, if you will, in the public. But, you know, Yoko, for diehard John fans, though, they got the whole thing with Yoko and John, right? And but it seems that their peace crusade and the other activist and artistic crusades they were embarked in the late 60s, including when they came to Canada, did cause a lot of Beatles fans to kind of scratch their heads. What is he doing? You know, what are they doing? This is bizarre stuff, right? So, yeah, so it caused a rift with some fans, but overall, I think, you know, John Lennon, just because of his prior presence in the media, his kind of cheekiness, you know, his wit with reporters and things like that, and by virtue of being, you know, half of the songwriting team, was hugely, had a huge impact on that generation.
It's fascinating to think, you know, at the beginning of the decade, just after, say, the beginning of the decade, you know, these kids, literally, become famous worldwide, and then here we are now at the end of the decade, and they've grown up a great deal. They've changed, obviously, a great deal, as what time does to a person.
Yep.
And how a segment of, say, your fans can just find that offensive. Well, you know, as you just said a moment ago, some, you know, half of them, if you will, understood where he was, right?
Yeah, and there's a whole period, you know, when John Lennon is doing his sort of activist and artistic thing and doing solo things, and, you know, then when they finally break up and he ends up moving to the States, and, you know, I mean, you know, he kind of was, he was still important, you know, and but he kind of was falling out of the limelight a bit, and you know, my book is only looking at 1969, early 70, but it's when he's murdered, which was just, the anniversary was just last week,
right,
4 years ago, that becomes like the dead pop star that he used to joke about. And that's sort of the John Lennon that many people tend to remember, that kind of martyr to peace.
Yeah.
The John Lennon I'm looking at is a very interesting, somewhat divisive figure, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah. The marvelous thing about your book is because I was never, I'm 38, but I was never a Beatles fan. I mean, I understood who they were and enjoyed some of the music. So it was great to read about them, read about the music scene, which we'll talk about in just a sec. But the other thing that I found just delicious about your book was the sort of time capsule that you give us of Canada in that year, because it was, for Canada, a very fascinating period. I mean, this was just after the centennial year, which changed how the country felt about itself and how people viewed the country, its history, and themselves. And it was moving into, because, you know, spoiler alert, we're moving into to the 70s and a very mm-hmm. different time.
Yeah.
You know, you, when you write about the country, I mean, it seems pretty quaint. It's stayed in many areas. But it's changing a great deal, isn't it?
Yeah, and that was actually, you know, that was a suggestion of the publisher. And at first I was a little hesitant because I thought, boy, you know, I mean, there's a lot of other academic publications on Canada in the 1960s, and I was looking mainly kind of for straight media and pop, you know, pop uh-huh. culture story, but as I started writing those sections, it did make sense, and what I ended up producing, I think, was a bit of a time machine for people to go back to that year, and, it, you know, I mean, maybe other writers could pick another year. I think it's kind of a neat way to look at the past, right? And but yeah, I wanted to get the flavor of what was going on, just so the readers would have a lot of context, and particularly for, you know, there's a lot of Beatles fans who just like the Beatles, you know, pop star information. But I was hoping that this could be a way to get non-Canadian readers to maybe read about Canada as well.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a non-Canadian listening to this, and you know who Justin Trudeau is, obviously, from contemporary popular culture, contemporary politics, understanding even why he's prime minister today because of who his father was and what his father meant to this country in that time, both good and ill, you get a sense of that, those early years especially, don't you?
Yeah, and I tried to find, you know, much like John Lennon, Pierre Trudeau, you know, was he was an ambivalent person, but, you know, it's ironic that Trudeau mania sort of was partly built on the hype, which is the sort of the response of the media and the public to Trudeau as a candidate for the Liberal Party leadership in 68, and then the federal election of 68,
mm-hmm.
and maybe for a few months after that, was the term was stolen from Beatlemania. He was a pop, you know, he was a kind of a celebrity politician, and he became, I think, Canada's first internationally known celebrity politician. And so, but, you know, much like John Lennon, not everyone was a fan, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, you can see he was a product of his time in terms of attitudes towards women. He wasn't totally enamored of people on the left, you know, although he was much more open-minded than many of his contemporaries.
Yeah, and then it's fascinating to think, because when you see the photograph of the three of them meeting, you know, for a lot of people that suggests what this era was. You know, here you had the sort of swinging bachelor prime minister and John Lennon and Yoko Ono.
Yeah.
But we forget that Trudeau was a generation before them, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. he was about 51 or something at the time. And again, a lot of people lost sight of that as well.
Right,
look at a lot of political cartoons and things at the time, is that, you know, Trudeau had that sort of aura of youthfulness for some reason. And the fact that, you know, I try to put a few anecdotes in the book where I don't know if he was actually was genuine or he was trying to impress people, but I get a kick out of, I think there was one incident where he's at a formal dance at Rideau Hall or something, and there was like a big, you know, a military band providing dance tunes, and he said, well, I want a Jefferson Airplane. You know, I really doubt he had a collection of Jefferson Airplane records. You know, whereas what's interesting, a lot of the contemporaries were almost going out of their way to deny that they knew anything at all about pop music, because I think they didn't want to offend their older politicians or older electors and or electorate. And I think that's another thing that's a real key theme in the book. It's just the generation gap.
Yeah,
how you responded to John Lennon was often a product of what side of the generation gap you were on, right? Which is typical of a lot of issues of the day. So it's almost like he was a symbol of all of that, although he was approaching the dangerous age of 30, you know. But he was an icon for a generation.
Yeah.
And his, but also it's interesting. By 69, a lot of his fans were a little bit older.
Mm.
They were no longer 13-year-old, you know, 12 and 13-year-old or 14-year-olds from 1960. Of course, they were recruiting new fans as well.
The other
the cultural power of their music.
Yeah, yeah. The other fascinating thing, Greg, is we get a sense of just how media savvy they all were. And I'm referring now to Trudeau and Lennon and Ono. Because there are great contradictions in who they were, and you know, people would criticize them at the time for these contradictions. Yet they use the media to say, I don't know, sort of stress them in a way, and that's how they got the attention that they got in their respective careers.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Beatlemania. I mean, not everyone was able to see the Beatles. You know, it was electronic media. That's what pop music was by then. But just even the Beatles as a cultural phenomenon, they became a great interest to newspapers, magazines. You know, and a Beatles story was always popular. Right, and then, you know, what was really interesting when I read some of the accounts of their press conferences. I didn't get into the early Beatlemania years in Canada. I mentioned, you know, mm-hmm. in Canada in 64, 65, 66. It's really interesting. You know, we had a lot of you know, hard bitten, whiskey drinking, chain smoking male reporters who probably fought in World War II. You know, just like something out of an old movie. But a lot of them are really excited that they were in the same room with the Beatles.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, and there was always a lot of Beatles fans in Canada early on as well, per capita, right? So the record sold early here, but Sir Trudeau certainly, there's academics have written on that in some depth on his use of media and the staging of the image of Trudeau in 68, and you know how that began to sour quite early, I found evidence of Trudeau mania, you know, him being very. You know, people wanted to meet him, you know, well into the 70s, right?
Mm-hmm.
Particularly young people. There was a buzz about him. And that meeting in December of 69 during the third visit in Ottawa, the third visit of John and Yoko to Canada that year, that was a planned visit, but it's really interesting. It wasn't, you know, Trudeau's people and Trudeau did not want a press conference. They wanted a photo op, right?
Yeah.
And they didn't ask any questions. They weren't allowed to ask questions of Prime Minister and the celebrities, you know, just take pictures. But later, John and Yoko spoke to the press and gave all those famous quotes. He's a beautiful person. Canada doesn't know how lucky it is. You know, if the world had more leaders like Mr. Trudeau, we'd be a lot better off. You know, so, you know, and that's all great press for Trudeau, right?
Indeed. How do you explain that for people like me, what a bed-in is?
Well, bed-in is that's kind of a you know, there was a lot of so-called inns. It came from the sit-ins of the phrase and the concept of having a kind of a more of a protest in the most common iteration. A number of other sort of 60s events sort of used the name inn. But it started the sit-ins, the passive resistance protests of the civil rights organization, and then they would start to have when the hippies started to appear on 66, 67, they would have love-ins, which, you know, it's not as pejorative as it seems, just people getting together, singing, dancing, you know, and kind of hanging out in groups, and, you know, often, you know, with their hippie garb on. And then, so, you know, teach-ins was another thing, you know, when there was an issue on campus, sometimes younger faculty and students would get together and have this informal, almost like a group meeting sort of seminar, an informal thing to bring, you know, talk about issues of the day in an informal way. So there were a lot of these so-called 60s happenings with the word in on the end. And the bed-in, that's just, you know, that was their idea of having a protest for peace. And but the whole idea was to draw media attention, and it worked. You know, they had their first one in Amsterdam after they were married in 68, and then they, as I detail in the book, and of course many other biographers of John Lennon have detailed in more detail, he tried to go to the United States with Ringo Starr and others who were, I think, cruising over on the Queen Mary or one of those big ocean liners. John could not get into the United States because of a recent drug conviction, so they went to the Bahamas, I think it was, and then they decided they didn't like that, and they ended up going to Canada just at the last moment, and it wasn't really planned. And you know it wasn't planned because, they did, as I pointed out in the book, they didn't alert the press.
Mm.
And they had, like, press officers with them. They always would issue press releases and call up. You know, John Lennon was a well-connected guy with the rock, the music reporters, right, Rolling Stone and all that. So, but even the regular news reporters, right? And so they didn't do that. They just showed up in Toronto. So that was not typical for them because they were, you know, very media savvy, and they would, you know, they always had like a camera crew with them filming, you know, footage in case they could use it in a movie or something like that, or for what we would now call a video, music video. So yeah, they were very media savvy, and even when they came back in December of 69 on the third visit, you know, they came back, they were kind of lured over by some savvy young Canadian entrepreneurs to talk about a peace festival in Canada for 1970 that would be bigger and better than Woodstock. Right? Of course, it never happened, but something happened, which I detail in the book. And, you know, they went to Ronnie Hawkins' place in Mississauga, and they, you know, they did a lot of media from there, right?
Yeah.
Radio interviews, media came to them, and so it was, you know, it's interesting that Toronto, well, Montreal in May, June 69, and then Toronto, Mississauga area in late 69 were sort of the headquarters of these global media camp, you know, these were global in their reach, right? These peace campaigns.
Yeah. So the song "Give Peace a Chance," was that because we all know now that it is recorded at the Queen Elizabeth Hotel there in Montreal.
That's right.
Was it written in Canada?
Yeah, it was written the night or two before, right? And they were there for several days, and I have the date in the book when it's written, and you know, that's been well covered. Like whenever there's an anniversary of the bad end and that type of thing in Montreal, often the CBC and other media outlets will do a nice retrospective, and they'll try to interview people, and new tweaks on the story, that type of thing, right? And yeah, it was written in Canada, recorded, and of course, I was as a music fan, I was fascinated by the sort of history of the recording by Andre Perry, and the fact that the version you hear on the radio is not quite the version you or on the record, and it's not played on the radio as much as it used to be. It's not quite the version that was recorded in the room that, you know, you can go on YouTube and find the video of it being done, right? It was tweaked with some studio musicians in a Montreal area recording studio. And one of those musicians was Robert Charlebois, who was like one of the top Quebec rockers of the day. I found that very fascinating.
Yeah, the spine of the book really is where you talk about the music that was produced, the music that obviously changed in this era and how it was heard and played throughout the country. The music really does symbolize the times, doesn't it? I mean, I was thinking of the last 4 years and what we've just gone through, and sure, there'll be musicians and songs that might, say, capture or might remind us of you know, a year. But nothing really, say, you know, the sort of intersection of politics and pop culture, it's really more pronounced in the late 60s than say, even today, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's to get back to the Beatles. Of course, the Beatles weren't the only game in town.
Sure.
You know, but to get back to the Beatles, I mean, this is not me. I'm just drawing on a larger literature on the history of the Beatles and some academic and non-academic. People tend to forget that this was the age of, you know, singles, but the, you know, singles that people listen to in the radio and dance to and things like that. Of course, the Beatles sold a lot of them, but the Beatles really pushed the album as something in the music industry. So that, you know, and you could say they were kind of concept albums in a way, maybe. And so people would look forward, young people would look forward to the next Beatles album in a way that there's nothing like it now, except maybe looking forward to the next iPhone or something. I'm not sure the next, you know, next video game that everyone likes. It's just like, you know, What are they going to do next, and take their cultural cues from that? So, for example, if you you're a bit too young, but if you remember, if you look at the album cover of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, 1967, which is Canada's centennial year, and the summer of love in San Francisco, there, you know, Beatles are dressed up in kind of Victorian military garb and things like that, and well, people start dressing that way, you know, Beatles. Members of the Beatles start wearing old army jackets. People start wearing old army jackets. Beatles started wearing sheepskin coats. People started buying sheepskin coats. My wife, one of her prized possessions when she was young in Nova Scotia, was her grandfather gave her a pair of round glasses that everyone was calling John Lennon glasses. Right? And she prized. She didn't even need glasses. She wore them to school in junior high.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I know there's trends like that now for young people.
Sure,
as well,
yeah.
But the Beatles were just kind of cultural. You know, they were showing the way, you know, for youth culture. And again, I think would influence older people, too. You know, older people would start wearing sideburns, Beatle boots. So, you know, it's, and then once the Beatles, at least John, starts to become more of an activist, that's another cue for people. You know, the rest of the Beatles weren't quite as active. You know, George Harrison gets involved later with Bangladesh and you know, raising money and things like that, obviously. And, but, you know, Paul McCartney and Ringo were not really sort of activists. I mean, they had a little bit of support for decriminalization of marijuana in Britain, but it was pretty mild compared to, and sporadic compared to the things that John Lennon was, you know, started to get involved with.
The fascinating thing about your book is when you write about the music of the era, it seems like you're really enjoying it. I mean, I know you're a historian. You study politics and the sort, but was the music part, was that the most fun for you?
Yeah, I mean, I am a music buff, and I'm an amateur musician, and I, you know, when I was writing the book, I often had a lot of Beatles and 60s, you know, Hendrix, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I had that on the background, right, and it was and just finding some of these little details about music. And again, there are, you know, there's some interesting studies of Canadian pop music history and biographies and things like that, but there's still a story to be told. And I tell you that the person that, in one interview I was asked, at my book launch, we had a virtual book launch here in New Brunswick when it came out several weeks ago, and I was asked what person most surprised you in the research, and it wasn't John Lennon, it was Richie York, the Toronto-based rock writer, and he was a fascinating. I mean, John Lennon was, no question.
Sure,
John Lennon, Yoko Ono, fascinating. But I found Richie York is like a guy out of a movie, and he was such an important person in our music history. He passed away about 3 years ago in Australia, where he was from. When he retired, he went back there. His wife, Minnie, very kindly allowed me to use some photos in the book from Richie's collection, and Richie has a huge archive of Canada's pop music history, including, you know, hours and hours and hours of recordings, right? Like, for example, when John and Yoko went to Ronnie Hawkins, very colorful chapter, you know, they went to Ronnie Hawkins' house in December 69 and camped out there when they visited Toronto when they came back later in that year. You know, I think Minnie told me that Richie would just have the tape recorder going. So you can imagine, you know, what that would be like for a Beatles fan or an historian to have, like, you know, hundreds of hours of John Lennon talking, you know, at Ronnie Hawkins' house. I mean, but Richie York, I mean, he was such an important person, and he was like the right person at the right time, right? And he wrote for Rolling Stone, New Musical Express. He wrote for the the American Billboard, right? American Music Bible, and he wrote for the Globe and Mail. And prior to that, he wrote for other. I think he wrote for the Telegram. Or, you know, he was like one of those first rock and roll writers in Canada, and he wrote the first history of rock and roll in Canada in the early 70s. He was a passionate advocate for Canadian music. He couldn't understand why people weren't buying more Canadian music, right? And he also developed a relationship with Led Zeppelin, and I think he wrote a history of their band, Van Morrison. You know, very well-connected guy. Living in Toronto in 1969.
Yeah. And so when you look at the music of the era, especially Canadian music and how that evolves, this was as well a very important part in the history of Canadian music, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, particularly, you know, Toronto, every city had a scene, Vancouver, Montreal, but Toronto was where it was happening, right? And so, you know, I did try to, because so much of the story happens in Toronto, I do try to bring that in, and you know, whether it's the local bands, some of whom we hear of later or we don't hear of later, but then also the fact that the young entrepreneurs, that's another part of the story. You know, there's these young hip entrepreneurs are trying to do something in the music business, and it's not always lucrative. And so I was, I was fascinated with Johnny Brower, who also kindly agreed to be interviewed, the young promoter. And he was involved with John Lennon and the, brought John and Yoko over to the Rock and Roll Revival show in September of 69, and then, convinced them to come back to be involved in the Peace Festival. And prior to the Rock and Roll Revival, Brower had been involved with the Toronto Pop Festival, and then, so a lot of these are touring acts, the major touring acts of the day. I was really, intrigued to see that, major groups like The Doors and other groups that we associate with the mainstream of pop music in that time are coming to Canada, as well as all the Canadian bands that are trying to make it.
There are so many people that just pop up as characters throughout the book. As I said a moment ago, it's a marvelous time capsule of Canada and politics. People like Alan Rock and Hugh Siegel, they end up, prominent in later years, but in their younger years, played a part in Lennon and Ono.
Yeah.
Was it in Montreal? Or?
Yeah, it was Alan Rock was a young student leader at the University of Ottawa who enticed them up to Ottawa.
Right.
And, again, Mr. Rock was interviewed for the book, and he kindly let me use some photos. One of my things I learned about this book is that when you look, it's hard. You know, any photos of the Beatles, you pay to use them. So if someone could let me use photos for a very low price or for free, it really helped. So yeah, Rock. So it was in the middle of the bed end, and Rock came down. I don't know if it was like someone started a rumor in the press, as someone like Bob Dylan would say. So this idea that, someone's inviting John Lennon and Yoko Ono to go to Ottawa for a peace festival. And, of course, they were interested in meeting Trudeau, but they never really planned it. And so Rock came down, and someone said, well, you can't talk to John on the phone, but if you come down to Montreal, maybe ask him in person. So he showed up at the bed end. He was, clean cut, wearing a tie and that type of thing. Young liberal, he's not a member of the Students for the Democratic Society or anything.
Yeah.
So, but he invites them up for a peace festival, and as he said in many interviews since then, there was no peace festival. This all existed in my mind. So, it was kind of fuzzy whether or not Trudeau would be there, but Trudeau was definitely a draw. So they got up, they came up to Ottawa, and they took part in this festival, or this seminar for world peace in the lobby of the arts building in Tubbert Hall in Ottawa U, which is a bilingual university. Now, it was the summertime, so a lot of students weren't there. And Mr. Rock, when I interviewed him, said if it had been during the regular school year, there would have been a mob scene. Mm-hmm. And even then, as a detail in the book, there were several hundred people outside looking for John and Yoko, and the organizers had to kind of bend the truth a little bit so they all wouldn't kind of flood into this building.
So
it's interesting. Again, you'd be a bit too young to remember some of these people, but I got a big kick out of the fact that one of the panelists was Bruno Gerussi, who was a CBC actor,
later
with the Beachcombers. I mean, how Canadian can you get? But at that time, the CBC in the late 60s was experimenting with having non-traditional broadcasters on their morning show. So he was kind of, Bruno Jerussi was doing kind of like whatever the Peter Zowski show later became. Mm. He was doing that. And then there was an academic undergrad student, Martin Lonely, who was a new left, a radical student from, well, he was from Simon Fraser, you know, kind of a very radical place in the late 60s. And then John Yoko, but John did most of the talking at the seminar, and it was a big deal for Ottawa. When I was visiting Ottawa about two or three years ago, I did go and I toured the building, and I have to admit, I got a little bit of a thrill walking through that lobby and standing in the spot where the seminar took place.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So yeah. So rockets. So then you can see this on the Ottawa Beatles site. There's a very nice Facebook or web page, Ottawa Beatles site, where a lot of these things are documented. So later, there's nice little touches, Ottawa touches, like Hugh Siegel, who's the, he's like another student leader. Of course, he later becomes a well-known conservative senator.
Yeah.
Right. His job is to hold Kyoko, who's Yoko's daughter, who's with him at the bed, and she's only 5 years old, cute, very cute, and then go for a meal. So he heard they were vegetarian, so the closest thing he could find was a fish dinner from Nate's Deli, which was a famous deli down in the market area of Byway Market area of Ottawa. I think now Nate's is a chain, but, you know, an old-style deli, kind of, you know, with all the old pictures of the celebrities on the wall and that type of thing. And then after the after the seminar, they drove in Alan Rock's Volkswagen to 24 Sussex in case Trudeau was home. He wasn't. But they left a note with the housekeeper or whatever, right?
So, yeah.
And then they went back. You know, then after that, the couple went back to Toronto and they flew back to Britain, and that was the end of their visit. But it's interesting, and another little anecdote is that Mr. Rock says that when they were driving, of course he was driving. You didn't let John Lennon near the wheel of a car because he did drive. He almost killed his entire family. So they were driving in Ottawa, and the radio came on, and I think it was either Get Back. Get Back hadn't been released. It might have been the Ballad of John and Yoko or one of those songs that was fairly recently released. And John said, turn it up, you know. So it's a nice little 16,
yeah.
16, you know.
Yeah, indeed. The research process in terms of writing this book, you mentioned near the end of the book that this was written. I guess you finished the book, I should say, during these past few months of COVID.
Yeah.
But you'd done a lot of the research before, right?
Yeah, I had, but it was still difficult because it's such a detailed, fact-based book, particularly when you get queries from the editor, and then you just can't, well, for one thing, I couldn't even get into my office at work for a couple of months, and then forget about getting interlibrary loans or if you needed to do any sort of double-checking of an archival source. It just wasn't going to happen. But I did have a lot of scanned files from the newspapers, and I had interviews, and I had taken a lot of notes on publications, things like that. When I transferred over my electronic files from one computer to the next, I had 5,000 items.
Wow!
So I had a lot of items, but it was different writing, you know, it was, you know, because I think I signed the contract in December, but I already had, you know, several chapters done, right?
Yeah.
But it was, you know, a bit of rewriting, a bit of adding, as I mentioned earlier, adding that context on 1960s Canada. And the other thing that helped me is that I had been teaching a course on Canada during the 1960s. And so I had already taught that course once, so a lot of the issues were fresh in my mind, right? And I just finished teaching that course again this term. So the writing process was a little bit different, and I was on sabbatical too, which helped because you know, I was on sabbatical in the winter,
yeah.
And then but of course things start to close down here in March, I'm sure, like they did in your area as well.
Yeah.
And now the interesting thing about me going back to the origin story of the book is that what sparked the project was initially coming across the media story from the summer of 1970 that there was going to be a big rock festival in New Brunswick headlined by Led Zeppelin.
Mm.
And so that's how I first came across this whole idea, because I was, you know, I grew up with the Beatles, yes, but I was more of the era with Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple,
yeah.
Black Sabbath, you know, that early 70s, you know, stadium rock stuff, and so when I saw that, I was kind of shocked as a music fan, and so I saw this Strawberry Fields Festival. That sounds like the Beatles. So I started working back from that, and I found that the origins of the Strawberry Fields Festival were this peace festival that John and Yoko were pushing for Canada in 1970, and so then I started getting back into John Lennon, and I realized, too, because this was maybe about 3 years ago, that 2019 was going to be the 50th anniversary of the Dead End, of, you know, the Rock and Roll Revival, and of the visits to Canada. Of course, so I didn't get the project done in time for that, but close enough a year later.
And what was fascinating is I was reading the book. I read the book a couple weeks ago, but then I reread parts of it this week. It was all over the media about the 40th anniversary of Lennon's death. It was just eerie almost to have just read your book and to think about who Lennon was and what he meant.
Yes.
At the same time, as fun as it was for me to read, I mean, I know it's work too for you, but I can't imagine just how fascinating it was for you to write.
Yeah, I have to say, you know, compared to my previous book, which you interviewed me on, which was unfortunately about murder, this was, and of course, it's sad we know what happens to John later, but no, it is. No, I found it was a nice way to combine my interest in music with my academic background training on, you know, the sort of social and political history of Canada. And I also felt, you know, I always view every project like this, whether it's an academic article or a book, as I want to learn something, right? And you come away feeling that you've learned something, but also you feel there's a lot more you need to learn about that subject.
Yeah,
so there's lots of things. Like one of the things I think that is raised in one of the chapters, or maybe more, is the hostility and fear of rock festivals.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the act of opposition, right? And I think there's some academics looking at that, but it is, you know, it just strikes us. If you think later this is big business, you know, later different municipalities and places are going to be competing. Please come here and hold a festival.
Sure.
We want your tourism dollars. But the fear of young people, the fear of drugs, the fear of hippies, the fear of nudity, you know, and all these sort of comments about these dirty, smelly hippies are coming into our area. We don't want them. And the active role of the Ontario Provincial Police and trying to shut these things down is just such a striking, you know, and it really shows us that, you know, I tell my students, we can't assume that Canada was a touchy-feely liberal place in the late 60s. There was a lot of conservative opinion and a lot of, you know, hostility towards young people.
And then as we know later on, you know, 1970, it gets violent.
Yeah.
And deadly.
Yes. Yeah, and
country.
I found that was, to me, like kind of a bookend for the story, although, you know, John and Yoko will never come back to Canada after December 69, although there's a hope that they're going to come for the festival. I mean, Yoko comes back many times through as being an artist after John's death, but I did want to bring that contrast because, you know, the optimism, it's not totally optimistic. I mean, as I pointed out in the book, 69 was a bit of a dramatic year, particularly in Montreal, of different protests and, you know, FLQ bombs and things like that, but it still seems somewhat naive and optimistic, you know, based on our sensibilities now.
Yeah.
So I did feel I wanted to go, at least mention October Crisis, first of all, shows another side of Trudeau. But there's also an interesting contrast there, you know, or squaring the circle with one of the separatists that comes to visit John and Yoko during the Dead End, Jacques Leroux Langlois. He didn't plant bombs or anything like that, but he was part of the, you know, FLQ support network, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And he's on trial later, you know, rightly or wrongly, after the October Crisis. But, you know, he came to the Bad End and he didn't buy their message of peace. He was basically saying that, well, sometimes you have to do things to, you know, further your cause, and that's not what John and Yoko were supporting at that time. Right. He accused him of 12th century thinking, which I thought was a nice phrase. You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, whereas Jacques Leroux Langlois was almost giving a Malcolm X, you know, any means necessary, right?
Yeah.
you know, and so it's an interesting contrast. And I did want to point out that the world leader of that, I mean, admittedly, you could say the knowledge of Canada was a bit shallow, but yeah. The world leader that John and Yoko looked up to in 69 is the guy that sends in the army and proclaims the War Measures Act and says, just watch me. You know,
right.
When you know, the famous interchange you can watch on YouTube probably when the reporter asks, how far will you go? You know, Canadians are seeing men with guns in the streets, right? That's just something Canadians watched happen in the States mm-hmm. throughout the 60s, starting in 1965 with riots in the States. National Guard Army called out to suppress riots, and Canada had never really seen anything like this, or hadn't seen it in decades.
Yeah, you see this generation, you know, just really grow up very quickly in this time, don't you?
Yeah. Because of space, I couldn't really get into a long epilogue or final chapter, but it originally had a bit more detail on how Lenin was perceived or how he came into the media, like throughout the 70s in Canada.
And, yeah.
Well, it's interesting that, it's another story maybe, but throughout the 70s, you know, they give some attention to some of, because we forget, he did produce a few albums, had a few hit songs in the 70s, right? And then he kind of got quiet after he and Yono reunited and were living in New York.
Uh-huh.
But through a lot of it, he's almost seen as, by some music writers, as a bit of a has-been, you know, which shocks us now, right?
Yeah.
John Lennon?
Mm-hmm.
So this is a time when Beatles records are still selling, you know, throughout the 70s, the older records are still selling. His comeback album and then his tragic death in 1980, you know, kind of obviously reawakens interest in Canada, or in Canada, in the Beatles and John Lennon. And so, you know, 35,000 people at Nathan Phillips Square, downtown Toronto, that turn out spontaneously, right,
yeah.
And mourn him. And a lot of those people, you know, weren't alive when the Beatles were together.
Yeah. I could talk all afternoon with you about this book. This is such a fascinating book. What's next for you, by the way?
Well, I'm back to kind of a true crime thing. I've been talking to, but it's kind of this era. I've been talking to a gentleman who was a kind of a celebrity drug defendant in 70s and 80s Canada, and I'm talking about, look, I'm working with him, maybe looking at something on an accessible, lively, maybe based on his life,
yeah.
Look at the illegal drug trade in Canada in the 70s and 80s. No one's really done it. I mean, there's a few academic things. There's a few things on, you know, biker gangs and things like that. But
yeah.
This would be kind of a personal view. And this guy, you know, was fairly well connected, and he seems, you know, within reason, willing to give more detailed interviews and things like that. So I'm getting back to kind of true crime.
Mm-hmm.
Although I would love to return to another, you know, year in Canada or another sort of pop culture topic, right? I find, you know, maybe one book project every 2 years is more than enough, because it takes you a year to write it and another year to find a publisher, and then you have your other things you want to do in life as well.
Well, you've got such a great gift at whatever genre now. I've read two of your books. Whatever genre you're writing in, of drawing the reader in, and that Olin book is a fascinating, another fascinating book and written so engagingly as this book is. Greg, I appreciate your time today. Thanks for this, and continued good luck with the book.
Thank you for your kind words, and I hope to talk to you again sometime.